The views and comments expressed on the space show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The space show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the space show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to our Tuesday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in to another really good show with one of our favorite repeat guests, who I will reintroduce to all of you in just a minute. A couple of very quick announcements. Tonight, Tuesday, we're on the 60-minute format. So remember, if you have a comment, question, or email for our guest or phone call, make sure you pay attention to the clock so you can get it into us while we're still on the air. And once again, 60-minute format tonight. And then tomorrow we are doing Hotel Mars. Dr. Mike Wall is with us about weird things being found in the Martian soil. And then Thursday evening at 7 p.m. is the kickoff for the annual Space Show fundraising campaign. It goes until the end of the year. I hope some of you will tune in and listen, because it's going to be different this year and very important as we move into our 19th year of existence and pushing 3,500 programs. And then Sunday is open lines, where we can talk about pretty much anything. You can talk to other callers, and you can certainly talk about what's on your mind. So a full week remaining for the Space Show, and we hope all of you join us for all of that. Our toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners, so just be patient. We'll answer, get you up on air as quickly as possible. Email remains the same, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. You can also post comments on our blog. So to do that, open up our website, thespaceshow.com. All the way to the far right for the upcoming show menu. This is the first program listed. That's also our blog page. So open it up, and comments are all the way down at the bottom. So if you want to post a comment or ask a question via the blog, you do so that way. As soon as you hit the send button, I'll get a copy of it and can bring it up on air. But we are a talk show, so once again, I say, for a talk show, the goal is to talk, not to do email. So we want to hear from you with your phone calls, 1-866-687-7223. Check out our website newsletter, upper right side on our website, and you can see all of our programs described in detail. In addition, scroll down and you'll see the programming we have planned for the rest of the year. And now we only have one date available, because December 30th has been taken up by John Spencer, well known on the space tourist cycle, and he has the Space Tourism Society. He used to be on the show all the time a couple of years ago, and we've sort of lost touch, like what happens when you're pushing 3,500 interviews. But John is coming back, and I'm excited to talk to him. So we only have one date available for 2019, and we are booking 2020 schedules right now. Everything we do is archived, so you can listen easily off of our website or very quickly download the shows for your whatever media player, computer that you want to use. The file sizes are not very big, so they don't take up a lot of space, and they go quickly. So if you have any questions about any of this, you obviously can get a hold of me, please, at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We also have the email newsletter that we send out at 6 a.m. Monday morning electronically. It's very short, just one or two lines about the programs for the week. If you would like to get that email newsletter sent to you, then email me and make sure I have the email address that you want me to use. And again, keep in mind that we're coming up on the gift-giving season. So the Space Show does have a store through Cafe Press. and perhaps you'll find some gift ideas for your favorite Space Show listener. If you want to see what's available with Space Show logo wear, including phone covers, bumper stickers, pens, you know, t-shirts, shirts, baby clothes. I just sent baby clothes to some friends of the Space Show that have just had a newborn. Also dog clothes. So look for Pepper listening to the Space Show on any of our website pages and click on Pepper's pretty face, and she will take you to our Cafe Press store. And hopefully that works for you and you find some items of interest, stocking stuffers or something of that nature. Upper left is a very important menu. It's called Listen Live. You'll see it. This tells you how to listen to live Space Show programs like tonight. And then our archives on the website, which are compressed MP3s, as well as podcasts. And we are on lots of well-known multi-platform podcast servers like iHeartRadio, TuneIn Radio. But we're also well-covered on the iPhone and Apple group and also the Android group. If you have any podcasting questions, please get a hold of me. Email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then probably to me, as I say every week, the most important part is the fact that we are a listener-supported Internet talk radio program, meaning all of our guests and our programming and what we do is made possible by those of you who listen to the show and those of you who support us with your contributions. We would not have great guests on the show like we have tonight and like we had last night and like we have coming up in the future without you. So the Space Show really has been made what it is today over the last 19 years by you, the listener, and we certainly greatly appreciate that. And we hope you continue to support us. So remember, we are a nonprofit 501c3 with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. That is our nonprofit parent corporation. If you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you get a tax deduction for your gift. If you're a California taxpayer, you also get a tax deduction for your gift. Check us out at the OneGiantLeapFoundation.org website. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. If you're interested in becoming an advisory board member, all of that information is on the One Giant Leap website. And we certainly do want to hear from you. There's a PayPal button for those of you who want to contribute electronically. You'll find that on the upper right side of our homepage. And that PayPal button also carries with it information on how to contribute via check in the U.S. mail. The checks are made to One Giant Leap Foundation, and the mailing address is listed there as well. And then, we also do have sponsors. Remember, the sponsors get their banner ad going across the homepage and change that banner ad as often as they want, and obviously they can change what that banner ad points to as often as they want. On the 90-minute program, we read a short sponsor message in the first and second segments. On the shorter programs like we're doing tonight, I simply give a great shout-out to our wonderful sponsors because without their great help, we would not be broadcasting Space Show programs. So we certainly shout-out to and thank Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, our latest sponsor, Astrox, A-S-T-R-O-X, AIAA, Moonwords, the Space Development Network, Celestis, the National Space Society, and the Space Plan. And we hope they're all with us for 2020. If you're interested in being a sponsor for 2020, please do email me, and I'd be glad to tell you about the program and talk to you about it. And we appreciate your consideration of that support for us. For tonight's 60-minute program, I'm happy to bring back Christopher Richens. He's the co-founder and CEO of RB Signals, which is a provider of global satellite comms infrastructure as service. He began his career as an RF communications engineer at Boeing Sea Launch, where he supported multiple launch campaigns from the ship-based Equatorial Launch Site. After business school, he completed an internship with SpaceX before joining Bain and Company as a management consultant. After Bain, Richens held management roles at Arcite Astronautics, which was Planetary Resources, Space Angels Network, Expedia, and Applause. He earned an MBA from the Darden Graduate School of Business at the University of Virginia as a Jefferson Fellow, a master's degree in astronautics from the University of Southern California, and a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering from Brigham Young University. And he and his company are based in Seattle. And Christopher was last with us almost a year ago, December 18th, 2018. I think he has been on the space show maybe three or four times. This might be the fourth or fifth time, and hopefully we'll see another fourth or fifth time down the road as well. Christopher, welcome back to the space show. How are you?
Very well, thank you. It's an honor to be with you tonight.
Well, a great honor to talk to you, and you educate us so much on communications and satellites and relative things like that. We don't really have another guest that does what you do or explains things like you do. What have you been doing for the past year? Have you guys been under the radar, above the radar, active, sleeping? What's been going on?
Well, definitely above the radar. It's been another incredible year. When we spoke the last time, I think it was December of last year, I was in Israel, and we had just wrapped up a great year in 2018. I think our revenues had increased about 3.5 times for the company over the previous year, and I'm pleased to say that we are going to exceed that growth figure this year for RBC Signals, and it's been a fun and exciting year, not just for RBC Signals, but for the space industry as a whole. I think we've seen a lot of exciting things happening, and RBC has been the beneficiary of a lot of that excitement. So I think there's a lot to talk about.
To lead off, because we always have new listeners listening both live as well as archives, and keep in mind we're on the 60-minute format, so this doesn't have to be the graduate school version. We can do the undergraduate school version. Explain what RBC Signals is, and also tell us who your typical customer is. And I know that from talking to you before the show started that your customer's kind of changing a little bit, and you're getting sort of a dual type of customer. So introduce us to all of that.
Absolutely. So the work that RBC Signals does is make it easy to get data from space back to users on the ground that can generate value from it. So a lot of people may not realize that a satellite in space, whether it is generating data itself through sensors that it has on board, or if it is transmitting data that it's receiving from the Earth, all of that information that passes through that satellite has to come down to Earth to generally a satellite dish that is pointed at it and has direct line of sight to that satellite. And that can be a tough problem to solve, and the reason that RBC Signals exist is because it was a tough problem that I had to solve at some previous companies of how do you, if you have a satellite that's orbiting the Earth every 90 minutes in low Earth orbit, how do you keep communication with it? Because that satellite will rise over the horizon and set again as it flies by in less than 10 minutes. And it might only rise overhead just a few times a day on any given location. And so if you want to communicate with your satellite more than just a few minutes a day, you really need to have a global network of satellite dishes around the world that can track your satellite as it's flying by to be able to retrieve that important data back from it. And if a small startup had to do that for themselves, it would be an impossible task, and it would make it impossible for them to be able to actually generate any value from their satellite, because unless you're receiving data from that satellite, there's no other way to capture value. And really, until we start doing space-based manufacturing, all of the value created in space is in the data that is generated by the sensors and satellites that are up there. So what RBC Signals is doing is really just streamlining that process of moving data from space to the ground and making it as simple as possible. And we'll talk maybe a little bit later about how things are changing in the way that those services are being offered. But you mentioned our customer base and who's using this. And I think one of the big changes that we've seen in 2019 is an expansion of the customer base, moving from just the, our previous customers were largely early stage space companies, new startups that were launching their first satellites into space that really needed a solution that could fit their budgets and fit their requirements. And RBC Signals was able to provide the flexibility and services that they needed. And what we've seen in 2019 is an extension of that beyond just the space startups to more established companies, but also into two other key areas, one being geostationary communication satellites. And these are businesses that have typically been in operation for decades or more, where they're providing kind of standard communication services with satellites that don't actually move in the sky. And these are the typical satellites that you would use for broadcast television and maybe things like XM radio or other satellite communication services. So moving into that more established communication market. And then the other big segment that has opened up for us in 2019 is government services. So we're very pleased to be on contract for multiple government contracts, U.S. government contracts to provide services there. And it's a great validation of both the business model and the applicability of the types of services that we're providing. And so we're very proud to be able to provide that infrastructure as a service.
So these expansions have really taken shape just in the past year. That's how much the industry is changing, correct?
That's right. I think the status quo or the culture of space coming in based on the last 50 or 60 years of space experience is that every company or every satellite needs to build its own ground station infrastructure. And so this whole concept of infrastructure as a service is going through a similar process that companies went through as cloud computing started to come online and enterprise compute, where at the beginning, big companies thought that they would never trust their data in a data center that was owned by somebody else. And over time, as smaller companies started to adopt those cloud technologies and those data centers, the larger companies began to get more comfortable with it, began to get more comfortable with the security, and eventually it became commonplace for companies of all sizes and even the U.S. government to be able to use cloud services. And that infrastructure as a service model has just been a similar process needed to happen in space, where companies and the government needed to recognize that it was okay for them to use somebody else's infrastructure to be able to receive and process this valuable data from space. And so it's been exciting to see that actually happening.
So I have your first email question, which is Alex, who is in Denver, Colorado. And he says, I'm wondering how you solved this problem, or maybe it's not as I'm going to describe. But if you have multiple customers, I assume that means you're tracking multiple satellites out of each of your ground stations, and you're probably receiving data back simultaneously from these satellites. So how do you track multiple satellites from the same ground station and receive multiple different satellite data feeds back? Are all satellites broadcasting the same way, and is data all the same way? Or do you have to have different systems for every kind of satellite imaginable? It seems to me an overwhelming problem to handle more than one at a time.
What a wonderful question. And it actually, unfortunately, is a rather complex problem. It's not quite so bad that you have to have something custom for every satellite that's flying. But one of the limitations of today's technology is that, generally speaking, one satellite dish can only talk to one satellite at a time. Because the beam, as it extends out to space, is fairly narrow, there's usually only one satellite that's communicating at the specific frequency that you're looking at. And in fact, there are regulations and coordination done globally to ensure that you don't have satellites talking over each other using the same frequencies or wavelengths of communication. But even with that, there are still a lot of different, just like your car radio would have FM radio for frequency modulation and AM radio and different stations that you can listen to in your vehicle. Satellites have a lot of different things, not just AM and FM, but a lot of different M's. And the radios on the ground need to be able to accommodate a lot of those different modulation types. And one of the innovations that RBC Signals brings to the market is to be able to have what we call software-defined ground stations. That means we use radios that can be configured on the fly to be able to support many different types of satellites as they're flying over. And if we get into a situation where there are multiple satellites in the sky that want to use the same antenna, well, then we have to go and we use a, we operate on a first come, first served basis with our customers. And if a customer really needs to have highest priority, then we're able to build infrastructure to be able to provide that guaranteed level of service to them. But it is a problem, and standardization is one of the tools and approaches that we are pushing into the market to be able to make it easier, just like your cell phones can communicate with towers of different companies. We want to make it so that your satellites or anybody's satellites can more easily use the ground infrastructure to be able to pass data through. And we think that that's certainly something that's going to be changing in the future, in addition to other technological advancements that will allow multiple satellites to be tracked by an antenna system that maybe isn't a standard satellite dish that's this parabolic dish tracking an antenna, but maybe we could use things like electronically steered antennas that you don't even see them moving at all, but they're able to steer electronically, invisibly, without any moving parts, and track multiple satellites at a time. But unfortunately, the costs of that technology are still such that it's actually cheaper to build many dishes on one site rather than just having one of these non-mechanical electrical solutions.
So if we were driving around the country and we happened to pass one of your ground stations, it would have an array of multiple dishes on the on its antenna pole.
That's right. You would see maybe several several satellite dishes kind of in a location, and they might be looking in different locations and tracking and moving in different directions as they're each individually talking to a satellite as it's flying over.
So is your ground station human-tended, or are they all robotic?
So we design them so that they operate in a lights-out manner so that they don't require human intervention. We do generally have personnel on call that can go out to those sites, and those are usually contractors. It's one of the ways that we're able to reduce the cost of operations is that we don't necessarily have a cast of thousands waiting for something to go bump in the night. We're able to use the latest in monitoring technologies and operations, distributed operation centers, so that we're able to keep an eye on our operations 24/7, 365, without necessarily having boots on the ground in every location.
Another email is where you're not even getting able to really tell us all about what you want to tell. You're answering questions. But Lindsay's in Nashville, and Lindsay said, I think I heard you say that when you're tracking LEO, you only hold the satellite signal for roughly 10 minutes. But then if you're doing geosats, you've got a totally different animal on your hand. How much time do you stay in communication with a geostationary satellite? And is that a completely different kind of tower and a completely different kind of dish arrangement? How does tracking and communicating with something in LEO compare to doing it with out of the same ground station something that's geostationary?
You have amazing listeners. I love these questions. So this you've hit on something that's really important. So a geostationary satellite is at a, in a very cool orbit. So the generally speaking, the closer a satellite is to the Earth, the faster it will be orbiting. The shorter the orbital period is what they call that. So the less time it takes, and the further out you go, the longer it takes. And there's actually this magical distance where the orbital period is exactly the same as the rotation of the Earth, so it's 24 hours. And so those geostationary satellites, the reason they call them geostationary is because they stay stationary in the sky relative to the Earth. So that satellite dish can actually stay in communication with that geostationary satellite 24/7, all day long. And so when we provide services to geostationary satellites, that antenna will be fully occupied by just that satellite, and it actually can't be used to talk to other satellites. So it's kind of a dedicated situation. So that's really the key difference in between the low Earth orbit and the geostationary, because the geostationary, and they're not limited. And also, you don't have to track as much. And so generally speaking, the geostationary satellite dishes don't have motorized tracking capability. They can, but generally they won't, just to save cost, because the satellites shouldn't be moving in the sky. The low Earth orbiting ones, however, are moving very quickly relative to the Earth and need to be tracked. But the radios that you're using to communicate with those, and the frequency bands that they're using, might be very similar. And so the technologies, you know, once you get into the ground station and through the antenna, might be identical.
So typically, how long do you hold a view of a LEO satellite? 10 minutes, is that about, and then you pass it on to another station?
On average, that's right. eight and a third minutes is the actual average length of our passes. You can imagine if a low Earth orbiting satellite passes directly overhead, that would be the longest pass. But if rather than coming directly overhead, it just kind of grazes the horizon, kind of comes up over and just kind of down on the edge, that would be a shorter pass. And they can be very short, you know, just a matter of seconds to a few minutes. And then the longest ones might be, you know, 11, 12, 13 minutes, depending on the altitude of the satellite. But on average, you're 8 to 10 minutes.
So that 8 and a third minutes transfers to how many miles?
So I would say, and these low Earth orbiting satellites are at a number of different altitudes, but anything from 450 kilometers to 650 are kind of rough figures that our customers are generally in for low Earth orbit.
And what do you do when the satellite goes over the ocean?
Well, then our customers, They hold their breath for now. If they're lucky, they get to fly over an island that has a ground station on it. And if they really have critical needs to be able to retrieve data at all times, there actually are solutions where you can use inter-satellite links to be able to, instead of beaming your data down to a ground station, you can beam it up to another satellite that can then relay that on. And I think you'll see more and more of that happening in the future. But for today, most of commercial satellite anyway does not require that level of always on connectivity. And most of the systems are designed to be able to handle brief periods of outages where you don't have communication.
So you don't have to worry about using a barge or a ship or something like that to pass your signal on.
So we could certainly do that, and in fact, that's how I cut my teeth as an engineer, was on sea launch, where I managed floating satellite communication stations out on the ocean. So it's certainly technically feasible, but they are more expensive to maintain and operate, and generally speaking, the satellite customers that we're working with aren't in a position to pay the higher costs for those and are just willing to deal with the outage.
So one of these new space satellite or imaging companies, rather than have this infrastructure, they contract with you to provide that infrastructure, and they communicate to your ground station.
That's correct. Yeah, they can pay us by the minute for when their satellites are overhead, and it saves them the cost and operations complexity and regulatory complexity to have to manage all of that themselves.
And so that's a more economic way for this new startup satellite company to go, correct? I mean, they would save money doing that, right?
Absolutely, and I would say not just the startups, but I think even now we're seeing the geostationary companies and the U.S. government recognizing that it's a model that that really works.
Roy is in Tucson, and he said there's the deep space network for going further and further out. Could your ground stations take over some of the work of that, for example, Mars missions?
So I love that question because it leads into some of the other exciting things that are happening with RBC signals. So for missions that go beyond Earth orbit, typically that has only been NASA and national programs, whether it's NASA or other space agencies. And one of the things that we're working on right now that we're very excited about is we're looking at a future of communications being required for commercial missions beyond Earth orbit, whether that is lunar, Mars, or other destinations. And we're very excited that we've been contacted by several of the commercial companies that are involved in the CLPS program, that's the Commercial Lunar Payload Services program, as well as the Lunar Gateway programs, to be able to work with them to figure out how to get data back from those satellites. Because just like you would have a problem in low Earth orbit, you still need to get data from those far-reaching places back to the surface of the Earth. And if you can imagine the moon flying or orbiting the Earth up in the sky, if you could only talk to your lunar rover when you could see the moon, you know that there are going to be periods of the day that you would not be able to communicate with your rover unless you have a global network of communication stations. And those stations, those antennas need to be generally larger because they need to be able to communicate further distances. So I do think that there is an opportunity in the future to be able to provide services beyond Earth orbit for communication, both to NASA and civil space missions as well as commercial space.
So you have a listener on hold, but you also have this question, which I'm going to ask you because I think it'll be a short answer. It could very well be wrong. But Beth is in Wichita, and she says, I think a lot of us would really get off on tracking a satellite. Could you, for example, develop an app that let us track satellites as they went around the world? And we may not be able to decipher their data, but we could hear them much as we used to listen to the ping-ping of Sputnik go over many, many, many decades ago. Could an app do that with your satellites, or would it be a big invasion of privacy, or would it not be safe, or is the technology not there to bring that kind of game-like environment to individuals?
I love it. So there are absolutely ways that you can track satellites from home. You can use apps. You can build little antennas that you can put in your backyard or hang out your window to track these satellites. There are apps that will tell you when they're flying overhead. And there are some great resources on the web. And really all it takes is a computer, a little $20 USB stick, and a few dollars in hardware components that you can get at Home Depot, and you can be receiving live data from NOAA weather satellites flying over your house and get those pictures through your own ground station that you built in your backyard. And I've done that with my children, and I think it is a really exciting thing to do, and there's some great resources out there to do that. One that I would point you to is a group called SatNOGS. That's SatNOGS. SatNOGS is a group that serves amateur satellites, because just like you can have amateur radio and hams, you can have amateur satellites, and those signals are broadcasting in the open. You can track those, you can hear their pings, and you can receive data, and the SatNOGS group will show you how to build your own ground station, how to track those, and how to contribute the data that you receive from them back to the community. So it's an exciting project.
So that's kind of like the ARL for shortwave radio, right? Something like that?
Yeah, exactly.
Let's see who your caller is. Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Marshall.
Hi, Marshall.
I remembered earlier you said about needing to relay to ground station, and my first thought is relaying to one of the geostationary satellites, having a repeater on it to come back to the ground. And then I realized, well, wait a minute, that's what, a quarter of a second delay? But if you have a network in low Earth orbit, you can probably cut that down dramatically to, you know, 1 millisecond or something silly like that. Is there going to be anytime soon an internet of relay satellites that should be extremely easy to communicate between, you know, just like the internet?
So thank you for that question. So there are several companies that are working on projects like that. So there's a company, SpaceX, that's working on a project called Starlink that looks to launch a lot of low Earth orbit satellites. It's still unclear whether they will be providing services to other satellites and providing that relay, but certainly, theoretically, there's the capability there. OneWeb is another company doing similar things. Amazon has their own, they're calling Project Kuiper. So yes, there are a lot of companies, and there are existing companies, companies like Iridium, and Globalstar, that, some satellites do use, for real-time connectivity, usually pretty low data rate, today, but in the future, there could be even broadband speeds, available, but there are some complications when it comes to the regulatory environment and how to manage those inter-satellite links, but it is something that I'm really excited about because it would be a convenient way to move data from space to the ground. It's something that we're excited about.
So one of four or five companies is probably going to pull it off, and I presume there's a lot of money in it.
I think so. I think that not only is there a lot of money in it, but it's one of the things that I'm probably the most excited about in the entire space industry is thinking about what happens when you cover the world with internet connectivity, broadband internet connectivity, and bring the benefits of education and knowledge to every person. I think that there's just a lot of discovery and a lot of innovation, and I think that the pace of that is going to grow exponentially as we increase the number of people connected to the knowledge resources of the planet.
Yeah, it also comes in there and will eliminate individual countries from going through your email and everything else saying, oh, you're politically correct, you're not politically correct, and et cetera, because everybody be directly linked.
Well, we can certainly hope. I think that that's something that is a hot topic as you go to countries that do like to have more control over information access, and they are looking at what they can do to be able to protect the sovereignty of their countries and the rule of law in the face of these technologies that may make it easier to provide access to information outside of those bounds.
Yeah. I'll let somebody else talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What specifically, I'm not asking you for the technical details, but I'm interested in cybersecurity. So I have been fortunate enough to have been involved in the theft of data with you, with network solutions. Let's see, Yahoo, Equifax, Wells Fargo. I mean, companies that should know better, okay, and have the resources to protect people. And it seems that there's no protection for anybody, no matter how big and how much money these companies throw at it. Do you have a security problem? Do your customers get hacked? I mean, if Wells Fargo and all these big giants can't protect us, how can you do that for your customers?
So I would say that we are no worse off than the big giants. RBC Signals, and I think most satellite operators would say that they are employing the standards that that are provided for cybersecurity. Basically, it's something that we think about a lot. We know that there is a lot of maturation that has to happen within the space industry to really get to a level of security. You would be shocked to know how few satellite operators actually encrypt their information streams. And I think that's something that will be of greater importance going forward, because when it was just a few satellites up in space, I don't think it was as big a concern as it will be when we're going to go from, you know, 1,500 or so operating satellites in space to tens of thousands of satellites operating in space. You know, what is that going to do for, you know, how is cybersecurity going to impact that? And I think it's a concern. But I would say that for us, the cybersecurity measures that we take are really the same that you would take for any kind of electronic data. It starts with physical security around the sites. It starts with security in your personnel and training them to be aware of phishing and other attacks that, that might try and compromise, the security of our networks. And then using good encryption algorithms to be able to secure the data both in motion and at rest.
Why would a satellite company not encrypt their stream, given this being 2019? And when these breaches happen, they're on everybody's news service for weeks and weeks, and then there's huge settlements and court decisions. I mean, why would you not do everything possible and encrypt your stream? And wouldn't the customers just automatically assume that that's being done?
Well, and I think you've hit on it, is that I think a lot of them don't have customers.
Well, then how do they earn money?
Well, and I think a lot of the growth of the industry are in companies that are just starting with their test and demonstration satellites, and they're just bringing up their commercial services now. And so I think that the ones that are already in service definitely have paid more attention to cybersecurity. And I don't want to say that just because they don't encrypt the data on their satellites that they're ignorant of cybersecurity. There are a lot of different ways that cybersecurity can be implemented. But I would say that there are opportunities for enhancements there. And I think as regulation and as customers – demand those things that you'll see that. I mean, certainly the government is encrypting their information, and I think that the commercial industry will follow.
Is there any truth to what we always hear, is that the bad guys are always a step or two or three ahead of the good guys, so it's an impossible battle to win out over?
I don't know about impossible, but I would say that there are any time that there is value, that there will be people working on both sides, good and bad, to access it and to protect it. So I think there is a lot of money being spent and a lot of effort being put on how to access that value illicitly and how to protect it. So I think that this is just another front for that battle to be fought.
Caller, are you on the line? Hello, caller. I thought we had a caller on the line. Caller, are you with us? I guess not. Okay, I guess maybe they hung up. I'm on your website. You don't publish like a newsletter that we can subscribe to for satellite news and news about what you're doing. That's not available yet, is it?
That is not available at this time.
Any plans for that kind of feedback and communication in the near future?
There are a lot of great sources out there for space news, this program being one of them. There are other newsletters out there, so I don't know that we'll necessarily get into that, but we do work to publish articles in various journals that convey our point of view on important topics, and so those are definitely out there, but whether we start to publish something ourselves is not in our immediate near-term plans, but could definitely be part of our future plans.
An email from Paul in Houston, and he says, earlier you talked about success and growth rates. What do you see your growth rate will be like? Can you sustain this high level of performance and growth, say, over the next 5 years and then the next 10 years?
I would love it if that were true. I think that as you grow, growth rates, not just, 10 to 15%, but, 3 to 4 times revenue growth gets harder to sustain as the base of growth gets larger. So as much as I would love that, I doubt that we would sustain that over 10 years. But I do think that there is a period of significant growth still ahead of us. And as we talked about, these mega constellations, so these are satellite constellations of many hundreds or even thousands of satellites, there is a lot of infrastructure that's going to be required to communicate with all of those satellites, and a lot of that will have to be new infrastructure that's built, and we believe that we're in a good position to be able to support the growth of those communication needs, and so I think we've got some good years of significant growth ahead of us.
Randy has a question for you out of Tucson. And says, you're a relatively new company. I don't know how many years you've been in existence, but I would assume you can morph into new equipment and new technologies very rapidly, and you're not saddled with a lot of old-fashioned, out-of-date, or marginally okay legacy hardware. Can you comment on legacy and where you are today with going forward?
Sure. So there's kind of a good news and a bad news situation when it comes to legacy. So the same technology, basically, that was used to communicate with the Apollo program is still used today. If you look at the satellite dishes and the radios and things, sure, there might be some new digital technology, but by and large, the analog portion of that, the part that actually goes over the air and is touched by the antennas, a lot of that is the same type of gear that has been in use for decades. Now, there are some exciting things coming that I mentioned before, things like electronically steered antennas and such, that I think will start to change the game. Where we see a lot of excitement is around the software-defined radio, where you can actually use software rather than having to change obsolete hardware. And so as we get into this idea of rather than having to put new hardware all the time but just changing the software, it allows you to keep things fresh a lot easier. And it's just a development mindset that I think goes and allows you to have a more graceful maturation path of your technology. So rather than having to put a new box out there every time somebody comes up with a new great idea, you can just change the software, and then more gradually you can change your hardware as new things come out. And you might think of it like your cell phones. You can buy the new cell phone that comes out every year, but generally speaking, you can use a cell phone that's 2 or 3 years old without losing too much of the benefit of that new technology. Now, every once in a while, something really awesome will come out, and you'll need to do some upgrading. But generally speaking, even in a high-paced environment, it's possible to, when you have a software running on top of a hardware platform that isn't changing as quickly, you can manage that a little bit more carefully. And that's really what we're trying to do at RBC.
What about your regulatory environment? Is that getting better, getting worse? Where do you see it in 5 years?
So the regulatory environment is changing. So it's something that we pay a lot of attention to. It's a process that we participate in and providing feedback and engagement around. The regulatory wheels turn slowly, and it will almost always turn more slowly than the pace of innovation and development. So I don't envy the regulators in their jobs. I think they're doing a good job of staying engaged, at least in the U.S., and to some extent the international bodies. I see them coming out to conferences, talking to members of the commercial community, and but it's something that requires a lot of political savvy and diplomacy and just trying to figure out how to penetrate the bureaucracy, because the regulation is generally around the use of radio spectrum, and that spectrum is a national resource for the different countries involved, and it has a lot of value, and it needs to be protected and managed very carefully. And so it's something that that they do take very seriously, and we work to always make sure that we're helping our customers stay within within the bounds of those regulations.
What excites you most about your RBC signal activity going on in the next couple of years? What are you most looking forward to?
So I started the company because I feel like, and my co-founders felt, that the Earth is a better place when it is easier to benefit from space data and space technology. And so we're doing what we're doing so that we're basically lowering the bar of entry for people to get access to space data. And because we believe that if there are more app developers that have access to real-time pictures of Earth or have access to internet in remote places, that there are more and more tools that will become part of our everyday lives that will allow us to be more and more productive and hopefully enjoy a higher quality of life across the board. And the fact that, you know, we're now 4.5 years in, I started the company in June of 2015, and we're seeing that start to happen, and we're seeing some real benefits. We're seeing companies like Planet who are publishing an updated picture of the entire surface of the Earth every day. It's exciting to be to play a small role in that development.
Interesting and exciting. I have one other question, and listeners, there's still time if you want to call us. We can get your call 1-866-687-7223. So this is Jerome, and Jerome's in Austin, Texas, and he said we don't talk a lot about human spaceflight, but what are the applications for human spaceflight with something like RBC signals? I know you have to get the voice communications back down to Earth. Is that the application, or is there something different that humans bring to the table that you're not doing now with satellite data?
So I think that there are some things that are different. I think that the certainly voice communication is part of it, but as you think about the future and what people are going to be doing in space, I think there are those that share the view that space is a place, and whether that's in orbit around the Earth or on the Moon or other places, for industry and things that you wouldn't necessarily want to be on the surface of the Earth. So if we could take things that are dangerous or polluting or you know, too big or too ugly or otherwise, and export those to places in space, that, you know, we can have people living and working in those environments, and you know, rezone the Earth as a place for healthy living, then you can think about, well, what kinds of communication needs do you have when you're living and working in space? And it can be anything from entertainment to telemedicine to communication, internet, all of those different things. But I think any of the data needs that would go along with having a sustained presence in space of not just a few people, but hundreds, thousands, or millions of people eventually in space, and what are their communication needs going to be in between themselves and then back to the surface of the Earth.
Have you been approached by any of the companies, or have you approached them that want to do private sector space stations? I think there's three of them.
Absolutely. So anybody that needs to communicate with space or with objects in space are a potential customer of ours. And so we've absolutely been in contact with many of those that are trying to or proposing manned and unmanned space stations.
I have another question, and I think, you know, we still have time to do it. So this is Jim. Jim is in Sacramento, and he said, I'm thinking of space tourism, and I'm thinking of a hotel. So a hotel may contract with a company, let's just say AT&T or MCI or Comcast, to provide all the communications and cable and entertainment and TV for that hotel. So would you, for a space tourism hotel or orbiting station, be contracted the way, say, Comcast would be to provide all of the comms and entertainment for that orbiting space station hotel? Is it comparable to a hotel here on Earth with communications?
I would say absolutely. Just like a hotel in a remote place might use satellite connectivity to provide internet services and entertainment content to their customers, hotels in space will need to be doing the same thing. And RBC Signals is in a perfect position to be able to provide that type of service, both because we have the global network of communication stations to be able to track these things as they're going around the Earth, but also that combination of the data center services that we provide at the edge, so that content can be served right at the point of delivery up to the station. And so that's one of the things that we're excited about, is that it's not just about satellite dishes, but it's also about what do you do with that data that needs to go up or come down, and how do you process it and get it to the users really efficiently. And the data center side of that is really important, and so we're excited to be able to provide those services as well.
So with ground stations all over the world, obviously you don't get U.S. terms and leases and rules and laws and putting in ground stations. So I don't know how many countries around the world you're in, but I would assume that the variation there is as many countries as you're in. How do you do that? Do you have like whole departments that know the different laws and rules and real estate and this and that for every country you're going to go in? And how different is it, or are there international rules for a ground station so it's not individualized country by country?
So it is individualized country by country, and while there are international guidelines that individual countries will generally adhere to, every country has their own regulatory environment, both for the spectrum as well as for construction and the operation of the business and taxation and every other thing that a sovereign nation might want to control about what's happening within its territory. And we have an incredible team that manages that and understands that and helps us work with all of our partners and hosts to be able to make sure that we're in full compliance with all those regulations.
Do you ever face expropriation like we used to hear about in Central America, for example, with American companies being taken over, by the host country? Is there that kind of a risk for a ground station to be taken over by the country?
I think there's always a risk of that. And I think that it's relatively low for the it's not on the top five, I think, of things that I'm worried about at this point. But I think that as time goes on, that may change, and especially as space becomes a more critical part of everyday life for citizens of a nation. That could be something that needs to be paid attention to. But while it is a risk, anytime you have infrastructure, whether it's space infrastructure or any kind of infrastructure in another country, there's always a risk of some change that would where you would lose access to that that resource.
Have you visited all your ground stations?
I have not. There was a time when I had, but it's actually one of the beautiful things about the way that we operate our business is that we actually don't have to physically be on the site to be able to bring them into the network and provide those services. I do travel a lot, and I've seen a fair amount of ground stations around the world, but not all of them.
Do you know how many ground stations you have around the world?
So we're in over 50 different locations around the world now.
Okay. What should we have talked about that we omitted or been sidetracked to or didn't cover? Is there something that we've missed out or that you want to be sure to leave with us tonight?
No, I think that we've covered some really exciting territory tonight, and it's always a joy to be a guest on the show.
Well, it's real interesting to see how your business is changing from the first time we met and how you're now working with government and you're doing geosats and things that are very, very different from when we first talked about a couple of years ago. So do you still have competition or have you put them all out of business?
We've definitely put some of them out of business, but the good news is that a growing industry like this is going to require a lot of different providers, and so there's still healthy competition, and we've got a lot of great respect for our competitors and really enjoy the opportunity that we have to compete with them and to show our customers why we're a great option for their services.
Well, I'll look forward to following up with you again down the road and see how you've changed the next time we talk to you, because it's really fun and exciting to see this side of the industry evolve. I mean, we read about what's happening in communications and satellites and how that's where all the action is. And then you translate it for us into business growth. And it's, as I said, it's very exciting. So I look forward to continuing to watch you do that and talk to you about it down the road.
Oh, excellent. Well, we appreciate the opportunity to visit with you and your guests.
Thank you very much. Happy Thanksgiving to you and holidays and Christmas and New Year's. And we'll look forward to staying in touch with you later in 2020. So keep up the good work.
Thank you, and happy holidays to you as well.
Thank you. Listeners, thank you for calling and emailing with your questions. Remember, Hotel Mars, funding Thursday night. Friday morning is Dr. Kirby Runyon, and he's doing the NASA Interstellar Mission out of Applied Physics Lab at Johns Hopkins, and also planetary nomenclature that Dr. Alan Stern talked about a little bit last Friday, and open lines on Sunday. Everybody have a great rest of the week. Please keep looking up, and goodbye from Christopher, David, and The Space Show.